You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Kelly Sergenis.
And I'm Joe Lerza. In his first hours as president on Friday, Donald Trump ordered federal agencies to ease the burden of Obamacare, while his chief of staff directed an immediate regulatory freeze. Trump was joined in the Oval Office by Vice President Mike Pence, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, and other top advisors as he signed the executive order on former President Barack Obama's signature health law, which Trump opposed throughout his campaign.
The order directs agencies to minimize the unwarranted economic and regulatory burdens of Obamacare and prepare to afford the states more flexibility and control to create a more free and open healthcare market. It also tells agencies to waive, defer, or delay imposing any Obamacare provisions that impose fiscal penalties. Trump's order also ordered agency heads to encourage the development of a free and open market in interstate commerce for the offering of healthcare services and health insurance, a key component of Republicans' Obamacare replacement plan. In addition, Priebus sent a memo to all federal agencies ordering a hold on all regulations pending review by a department or agency head appointed or designated by the president. Asked about his first day as president, Trump described it as busy but good, a beautiful day. Trump also signed the commissions for his first two cabinet appointments. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly were easily confirmed by the Senate earlier in the day.
Both men were formally sworn in by Pence in a hastily arranged ceremony in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, where the Vice President's suite of offices is located. Most of Trump's first substantive acts as president will wait until Monday, his first full workday at the White House. Shortly after being sworn in, the new president signed a series of papers formally launching his administration, including official nominations for his cabinet. Sitting in an ornate room steps from the Senate floor, Trump joked with lawmakers, including House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, and handed out presidential pens.
A U.S. senator continues to alert taxpayers to what he calls egregious examples of waste within the U.S. government. Senator Rand Paul, chairman of the Federal Spending Oversight Subcommittee, has released the second installment of his Worldwide Waste series, a special project of the Waste Report. In addition to alerting taxpayers, Senator Paul wants to help reform spending and keep legislators accountable to the people.
As Part 2 examines, millions of our tax dollars are advancing the exports of other countries, while we increasingly find many of our own exports at a global competitive disadvantage, says a press release from Senator Paul's office. Pete Sepp, president of the National Taxpayers Union, agrees this is a problem. U.S. taxpayers often suffer twice when the federal government funds programs that promote exports in other countries, because that just becomes a justification for others to say we need to subsidize our own exports, Sepps tells One News Now. Taxpayers unfortunately get handed the bill two times when this kind of situation occurs, he continues, and the bills can run into the hundreds of millions.
Speaking of taxpayers, Senator Paul says young Americans are finding it difficult to break into the job market after college, yet their taxes help find jobs for foreign college graduates. American farmers, meanwhile, are vulnerable to economic pressure and rising costs, while at the same time their taxes support foreign farmers and foreign goods. We've had a lot of talk and way too many hearings in Washington, D.C. on waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government, says Pete Sepp. It's time for legislation to get passed and signed into law.
The U.S. Air Force conducted a second major strike in consecutive days, killing over 100 al-Qaeda fighters at a training camp in northern Syria. A defense official with knowledge of the strike told a handful of reporters at the Pentagon on Friday a single U.S. Air Force B-52 bomber and an undisclosed number of drones dropped 14 precision-guided bombs at noon Eastern Time Thursday on an al-Qaeda basic training camp in Syria, west of the city of Aleppo, near the border with Turkey, according to the official. The official described the fighters as core al-Qaeda.
A Pentagon statement said the camp had been operational since at least 2013. It was not immediately clear why the camp had not been targeted earlier. The latest strike, likely President Obama's last as commander-in-chief, comes a day after the Pentagon said two Air Force B-2 nuclear-capable bombers dropped 108 precision-guided bombs on two ISIS training camps in Libya, killing 85 fighters, according to officials. The round-the-world strike took roughly 30 hours Wednesday as both B-2 bombers refueled five times in mid-air flying from their base in Missouri. 15 U.S. Force tankers from five bases on three continents assisted in the refueling. A detachment of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana have been deployed since April to the Middle East, nation of Qatar, to participate in strike missions against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. The official said Russia had previously tried to take out the al-Qaeda training camp, but had been unsuccessful. The Russian Air Force conducts the majority of their strikes using unguided weapons during the daytime.
U.S. Air Force and Navy jets flying primarily at night using satellite-guided bombs were used. It's not immediately clear if President Obama authorized the strike in Syria. The official said the U.S. military is authorized to conduct counterterrorism missions against al-Qaeda anytime. The B-52 is a Cold War-era bomber that is over 50 years old, but still has the ability to loiter over the battlefield for long periods of time and carry over 70,000 pounds of ordnance. The defense official said no civilians were killed in the American strike in Syria and said there were no signs of Russian aircrafts when the American strike took place. In all, U.S. airstrikes have killed more than 150 al-Qaeda terrorists since January 1st.
The number of voters who want Obamacare completely repealed is at a new low, as is the number who want to keep it as is. And for the first time, more favors expanding the law than killing it entirely. Yet a new Fox News poll also finds a majority continues to favor at least partial repeal of the health care law. The poll, released Thursday, finds 57% of voters favor doing away with all or parts of Obamacare. On the other hand, 41% would expand it or leave it as is. When views are put into those two buckets, that's about where opinion has been for the last several years. Since 2010, between 54 and 61% have favored repealing at least some of the law, and 31 to 41% have favored keeping or expanding it.
What's new is only 23% want the law repealed entirely. That's down from 32% in July of 2015, the last time it was asked, and a high of 39% in June of 2013. At the same time, 34% want to repeal parts of the health care law, up from 22% in July of 2015. That matches a previous high of 34% in January of 2011. 13%, a new low, say leave Obamacare in place just as it is. The shift comes from both sides. In the new poll, 46% of Republicans want complete repeal. That's down 14 points since 2015. Among Democrats, support for expanding Obamacare is up 15 points to 52%. Almost all of those voters who backed Trump in the election want the law repealed entirely, 50% or in part, 45%, while most Hillary Clinton voters would rather see the law expanded, 52%, or left as is at 22%. Positive views of the health care law are up. 50% of voters have a favorable opinion, up from 41% in August of 2015. Unfavorable opinion stands at 46%, down from 54%. Those most likely to have a favorable view of Obamacare include voters with annual household incomes under $50,000. That's 55% favorable. Those under age 30 at 62%, non-whites 73%, and Democrats 88%. If Obamacare were repealed, large majorities think it should only happen after a replacement plan is implemented. That's 82%. And that it will be replaced with something new, 74%, rather than going back to the system that was in place in 2009.
That's something partisans on both sides can agree on. Roughly three quarters of Democrats and Republicans think the law should be replaced rather than going back to the old system. Republicans have long promised to repeal Obamacare and are well positioned to make that happen now that they control both houses of Congress and the White House. The U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate recently passed budget measures that are considered the first steps in the process. Meanwhile, by a 56-41% margin, voters believe it is the responsibility of the federal government to make sure all Americans have health care. 90% of Democrats think it's the government's job, more than four times the number of Republicans who feel that way. The Fox News poll is based on landline and cell phone interviews with 1,006 randomly chosen registered voters nationwide and was conducted under the joint direction of Anderson Robbins Research and Shaw and Company Research from January 15th to 18th. The poll has a margin of sampling error of plus or minus 3 percentage points for all registered voters. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joel Larza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. Jobs are returning to America's oil patch. With oil prices on the mend and an incoming president who is no enemy to drilling, energy companies in the U.S. are hiring again. In Williston, the North Dakota town that sits at the epicenter of the American shale boom, hiring activity has picked up in the first weeks of 2017.
Sean Wenko, executive director of Williston Economic Development, said oil companies operating in the oil-rich Bakken formation are hosting two or three job fairs each week. Four companies are expected to add a combined 300 jobs in the first quarter, partly driven by oil field services. The number of active rigs in the U.S. surged by 35 to a total of 694 this week, Baker Hughes said in its latest report. The U.S. rig count is now up 57 versus the same day in 2015. Schlumberger, the world's largest oil field services provider, said Friday during its fourth quarter earnings release that business was lifted during a period that saw oil companies drilling more wells. The turnaround fueled an increase of 3,300 jobs in oil and gas extraction and support services in November, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics.
It was the first increase since September 2014. Over the previous 2 years, the industry lost over 155,000 jobs. The uptick in drilling comes as President Donald Trump takes office. Trump and former Texas Governor Rick Perry, the president's pick to lead the Energy Department, are proponents of new U.S. drilling. Representative Ryan Zinke, Trump's pick for Secretary of the Interior Department, has pledged to explore an expansion of drilling on federal land. America's incredible energy potential remains untapped. It is a totally self-inflicted wound, Trump said in a May campaign speech detailing his energy plans. Citing Trump's proposals to soften regulations, outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas said the energy sector, specifically oil rig operators and pipeline builders, will regain its status as one of the hottest industries for new hires in 2017.
As drillers and job seekers flock to the Bakken Formation, Williston's population nearly doubled from 2010 to 2015. Officials don't expect the same type of surge they saw at the height of the boom, but the rebound in oil prices should feel a significant boost in 2017. This play really shows some long-term potential for us, Wenko told FoxBusiness.com, referring to the Bakken. it's a good indicator for us as far as what the industry is doing. They're investing in the billions and putting up long-term facilities. Williston, the country's fastest growing small city 5 years in a row, used the oil slump to catch up on infrastructure projects, including a new $240 million airport under construction. One of the big misconceptions is people want to say Williston went bust, Wanko said. The slowdown helped us catch our breath.
The industry is also pouring money into the Permian Basin of Texas. ExxonMobil acquired 250,000 acres of land in the Permian this week, paying up to $6.6 billion to nearly double the company's footprint in the lucrative shale play. U.S. oil prices climbed 2.2% to $52.51 a barrel on Friday, well above the sub-$40 prices seen last summer. Prices have continued to recover after OPEC's deal to coordinate production cuts, a move that further erased concerns over swelling global supplies.
Animal rights activists have shut down the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus for good. The company announced last Saturday it will shut down this spring after 146 years on the road. Our commitment to our animals is for their lifetime, Juliet Feld, chief operating officer of Feld Entertainment, said at a news conference Monday in Palmetto, Florida. Our job now is to find suitable homes for all our animals over the next few months. Feld Entertainment operates the iconic Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus.
Feld said the company is providing assistance to about 400 people who face losing their jobs. She said only a few of the workers might land jobs elsewhere in the company, which produces traveling shows from Disney on Ice to Monster Truck Jam. Feld said separation packages would be provided to those who lose their jobs. Those who lived on one of Feld's two-mile-long trains also would need help with housing, she said. CEO Kenneth Feld said he has known some members of the circus crew for nearly 50 years. This is not a win for animal rights activists or for anyone, Feld said. Animal advocacy group PETA cheered the demise of the circus and urged other acts involving animals to follow suit. Society has changed. Eyes have been opened. People know now who these animals are, and we know it is wrong to capture and exploit them. The company has vigorously denied mistreating animals, and the Felds reiterated that position on Monday. In 2014, Feld won a multi-million dollar settlement against the Humane Society and other activists over unproven claims the company was mistreating elephants. We won in court, said Kenneth Feld, but obviously in the court of public opinion, we didn't prevail. The Feld said they are working to find homes for scores of lions, tigers, camels, and other animals.
The company will continue to care for its retired elephants at its Center for Elephant Conservation in Central Florida. The end of the circus wasn't all about the elephants, they said. Let's face it, times change, Kenneth Feld said. Once there were three TV stations. Whoever knew there would be a food channel, a golf channel? We have a world of specialization, he said. He said plans are being formulated to preserve some of the classic circus memorabilia, but the company is moving on, he said. This week we had 26 tours going around the world. Two were Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey, he said. The company is a robust company, and we are always looking at new entertainment. The circus is the future. Until May, then it will be part of our glorious past, Feld said.
If you live in one of 15 states and you buy milk, you could be entitled to some cash back. USA Today reports that some people who bought dairy products since 2003 are due refunds as part of a $52 million settlement spun out of the alleged mass slaughter of 500,000 cows. The class action lawsuit filed in 2011 charged that cooperatives working together paid its members, dairy farmers who produce 70% of the nation's milk, inflated prices for their dairy cows, which were then prematurely killed, reports Bloomberg.
The alleged goal was to reduce the supply and bump up prices. A University of Missouri professor tells USA Today the 2003 to 2010 herd retirement program did just that, cutting our milk supply by some 1.2 billion gallons while doubling the price of raw milk. A lawyer for the plaintiffs called the program a classic price-fixing scheme. The milk producers denied the charges, but said they settled to avoid expensive litigation. Milk products included in the deal are cream, yogurt, cottage cheese, half and half, cream cheese, and sour cream. The states involved are Arizona, California, Kansas, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, Oregon, South Dakota, Tennessee, Vermont, West Virginia, and Wisconsin, plus D.C.
Refunds will vary according to how many people apply per time. The deadline to apply is January 31st. See www.bottmilk.com, which projects individuals can get up to $20.
South Korea wants to create an ultra-fast train it hopes will be able to carry passengers at almost the speed of sound. Officials in the capital of Seoul hope the near-supersonic mode of transport will be able to travel more than 620 miles per hour, drastically reducing journey times in the country. It would operate inside a low-pressure tube, and if development proves successful, could travel along at twice the speed of magnetic levitation trains, currently the fastest in the world, capable of reaching 268 miles per hour.
According to the Korea Times, the train will almost reach the speed of sound, just over 767 miles per hour. The Korea Railroad Research Institute said, "We hope to create an ultra-fast train, which will travel inside a state-of-the-art, low-pressure tube at lightning speeds in the not-too-distant future. To that end, we will cooperate with the associated institutes as well as Hanyang University to check the viability of various related technologies called the hypertube format over the next 3 years. Many countries, such as the United States, Canada, and China, are competing to take the lead in this futuristic technology, and we will also try to preempt our global rivals. The government has focused on an interdisciplinary research, and this will be the biggest effort we are working on to develop a representative future technology. It comes months after it emerged that Hyperloop, a futuristic transit system that allows travelers to reach their destinations at high speeds, is coming a step closer to reality. Los Angeles-based startup Hyperloop One has started construction on a development that could potentially become the world's first Hyperloop transport system. The Hyperloop system was unveiled by Elon Musk in 2013, who said it could take passengers the 380 miles from LA to San Francisco in 30 minutes, half the time it takes to take a plane. It is essentially a long tube that has had the air removed to create a vacuum. The tube is suspended off the ground to protect against weather and earthquakes. Passengers could sit in either individual or group pods, which would then be accelerated with magnets. Capsules carrying 6 to 8 people would depart every 30 seconds, with tickets costing around $20 each way.
The cost of building a line from LA to San Francisco has been estimated at $16 billion, although critics say it would be near to $100 billion. The first tube of DevLoop, which looks set to become the first full Hyperloop system, has been successfully installed in a desert in North Las Vegas. Earlier this month, Dubai officials announced a deal with Hyperloop One to study the potential for building a line linking it to the Emirati capital of Abu Dhabi within the next 5 years. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Redbox Media. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit struck down Chicago's ban on gun ranges on Thursday, calling it unconstitutional.
The rules preventing the building of gun ranges were contained in a body of ordinances that allowed gun ranges in manufacturing portions of the city only, while placing limits on the distances gun ranges can be located in relation to other gun ranges and to residential areas, schools, parks, and places of worship, according to the Associated Press. The city has provided no evidentiary support for these claims, the court said, nor has it established that limiting shooting ranges to manufacturing districts and distancing them from the multiple and various uses listed in the buffer zone rule has any connection to reducing these risks. Another portion of Chicago's ban was a prohibition on anyone under 18 entering a gun range.
The Seventh Circuit struck down this ordinance as well. One of the three judges on the Seventh Circuit panel was Diane Sykes, who was on a list of 11 judges President-elect Donald Trump made public last year as among those he would consider as candidates for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Illegal immigrants from Mexico are flocking to the U.S. border to get into the country before Donald Trump begins enforcing immigration laws already on the books and begins legislation to build a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Mexican authorities are arresting thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, of undocumented migrants each month, according to government figures. Governors of several northern states in Mexico this week called for extra resources to deal with the surge. Laura Ramirez, a local charity activist, has been serving more than 200 free lunches a day to migrants. In his inaugural address on Friday, President Trump reiterated his campaign promise to build a wall along the border.
A library book that was checked out 100 years ago was returned this week. The San Francisco Public Library says the book is titled 40 Minutes Late and was actually checked out of the library 100 years ago by Phoebe Marsh Dickerson Webb.
It's a collection of short stories that took a long time coming back to the library. Dickinson's great-granddaughter, Judy Wells, hopes people give her dear departed relatives some slack, since Dickinson was 83 when she borrowed the book 100 years ago. She died before the book's due date. Another great-grandchild, Webb Johnson, found the book in a trunk of Dickinson's things back in 1996. He kept it for a while and even read it himself, he told the San Francisco Chronicle. Head city librarian Luis Herrera didn't read the family the riot act for keeping a book out for 100 years. He was just happy to get it back.
The current fine rate is 10 cents a day, which would work out to around $3,650, according to the Chronicle. However, the library's current amnesty program for overdue books means Dickinson's descendants won't have to pay a fine at all. Now, 100 years later, it's possible that 40 Minutes Late could go back into circulation or be put on display.
The caffeine in your morning cup of joe may do more than jolt you awake. It may also help dampen the type of inflammation that's linked to heart disease risk factors, a new study suggests. Researchers found that an inflammatory mechanism was dialed up in certain older adults, but not others. When it was highly activated, people often had high blood pressure and stiff arteries. But in lab experiments, there was evidence that caffeine blocked this inflammatory process.
No one, however, is saying that a morning cup of coffee is a magic bullet against aging. Still, the findings might help explain why past studies have linked higher caffeine intake to a longer life, said lead researcher David Furman of Stanford University's School of Medicine. The human body has probably hundreds of pathways that contribute to chronic inflammation and various diseases, according to Furman. We identified one of them, he said. Furman added that substances other than caffeine might influence the inflammatory process. He pointed to the well-known example of omega-3 fatty acids, which can ease inflammation. A researcher who wasn't involved in the study also cautioned against making too much of the caffeine finding. What's really important is that the study points to some molecular targets for new treatments to fight chronic inflammation, says Gabrielle Fredman.
Fredman is an assistant professor at Albany Medical College in Albany, New York, and a grantee of the American Federation for Aging Research. Researchers have long believed that lasting low-grade inflammation contributes to most age-related chronic diseases, including heart disease, arthritis, dementia, and many cancers. Fredman noted that existing anti-inflammatory drugs have side effects, including immune system suppression, which aren't desirable in older adults. So, she said, scientists are trying to develop treatments that target specific culprits in the chronic inflammation process. Whether caffeine could be one of these treatments is unclear. There's some suggestion in this study that moderate caffeine might be enough to quell some of this inflammation, Fredman said. But she stressed it's not too early to tell what it all could mean. They didn't do a clinical trial that tested caffeine, Fredman pointed out.
Definitely more studies need to be done. The study, published online January 16th in Nature Medicine, included over 100 adults. For the past decade, the participants have taken surveys, given blood samples, and had their medical histories reviewed. Furman's team compared blood samples from the younger and older groups to see which genes were more activated in older adults. They zeroed in on two clusters of genes in which all of the members seemed to work together. Both clusters are involved in producing a potent inflammatory protein called IL-1 beta. It turned out that the older adults could be separated into two groups, those with high activation in one or both gene clusters, and those with low activation. Of the 12 adults in the high group, 9 had high blood pressure versus only 1 of the 11 people in the low group. Those in the high group were also much more likely to have stiff arteries. On top of that, their blood tests showed differences. Older folks in the high group had higher levels of IL-1 beta. They also had higher levels of substances known as nucleic acid metabolites. These are breakdown products of the molecules that serve as building blocks for genes.
So, where does caffeine fit in? Those in the low activation group drank more caffeinated beverages. That led the researchers to take a deeper look in the lab. First, they incubated immune system cells with the nucleic acid metabolites that were prevalent in blood from the high group. They found that the metabolites boosted activity in one of the inflammatory gene clusters. That, in turn, caused the immune cells to churn out more IL-1 beta. When injected into mice, the substances triggered widespread inflammation and high blood pressure. Next, the researchers incubated immune cells in both the nucleic acid metabolites and caffeine. They found that caffeine appeared to block the inflammation-triggered substances. According to Fredman, the results point to some targetable substances for anti-inflammatory treatments. Past research has shown that IL-1 beta tends to be elevated in people with cardiovascular disease, Fredman said. And a clinical trial is currently testing the effects of IL-1 beta inhibitor in heart disease patients. On a broader level, Fredman said, the new study starts to get at a fundamental question. This can help us in understanding why some people age more successfully than others, she said. Why does one person have a stroke at age 60 while someone else lives to 100 and never has a stroke? It's not clear why some people have high activation of inflammatory gene clusters while others don't, but it's probably partly genetic, Fredman said. And there was evidence of that in the study, she added. Older people in the low activation group were 8 times more likely to have at least one close relative who'd lived to age 90 or older.
Pizza Hut is looking to fill 11,000 U.S. jobs for the Super Bowl and beyond. They want to make sure service meets rising customer expectations. The pizzeria chain, part of Yum Brands, said this week that its franchised and owned restaurants are aiming to fill as many as 11,000 U.S. jobs, many pre-existing positions as well as new jobs, in time for the February 5th National Football League Championship game, traditionally Pizza Hut's busiest weekend of the year. The jobs include pizza makers, delivery drivers, store managers, and others. The company currently employs about 120,000 people in the United States and has said it plans to get its store count to 8,500 locations from 6,300 currently within a few years. Though timing of the announcement is clearly intended to leverage interest around the Super Bowl, the jobs are not temporary and are aimed at helping Pizza Hut meet two goals, Kelly McCulloch, Senior Director of Human Resources at Pizza Hut, told Fortune.
A 2-year-old Florida girl who was found face down in a swimming pool with no heartbeat for 30 minutes is making a miraculous recovery. After a few days in intensive care, she was responsive and breathing on her own. In 2 more days, she was able to latch on and breastfeed for the first time since the accident. And though she was still experiencing pain, she was doing well enough that doctors transferred her out of pediatric intensive care. The next day, she broke out into a smile and laughed. A miracle. She is making marked improvements every day.
A college president says that he was fired for offering a homeless student shelter inside the campus library in sub-zero temperatures. Brian Carroll, campus president at Vatterott College in Kansas City for 5 years, says one of his students had no place to go. On Friday, January 6th, he allowed a student who is homeless and schizophrenic to sleep overnight in the school's library.
The school fired him on Monday, January 9th, the next business day. Education is a beautiful thing to me, Carroll told Fox 4 News, but sometimes it gets destroyed in the process. The recorded overnight temperatures outside Vatterott College on January 6th hit 4 degrees below zero. Carroll says that student had been sleeping in a wooden area near the school, but temperatures were too harsh that night, and the student had nowhere to seek warmth. I just didn't want to take the chance, Carroll said. We had ice and snow. I had a tough choice to make. He can't stay on campus. I can't put him in my car. I can't take him to my house. Carroll says the student had run out of his medication. He allowed the student to bed down in the school's library, and even though the student didn't steal or damage anything, Carroll was fired once the school's corporate leaders found out. The building has a series of surveillance cameras that can be viewed via remote, which is how Vatterott's St. Louis-based management team found out. I made a choice, he said. I was choosing between life and death. I'm not from here. I'm from Southern California. I'm not sure if I could live in the woods at -2 degrees, Carroll said. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after these messages.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Serginis. Barack Obama has tweeted from his original Twitter handle saying he and Michelle are off on a short vacation before they will return to work. Obama joked, "Is this thing still on?" as he returned to his personal Twitter account on Friday, just hours after handing his old @POTUS handle to Donald Trump. He changed his personal Twitter profile to read "Dad, Husband, President, Citizen." Hi, everybody. Back to the original handle. Is this thing still on? Michelle and I are off on a quick vacation, then we'll get back to work. Obama tweeted on Friday. The POTUS handle was used by Obama during his 8 years in office, but will now be used by newly sworn in Trump.
Obama, who has 81.5 million followers on his personal account, mainly tweeted from the presidential Twitter handle while he was in office. As Trump was sworn into office on Friday, his new official account appeared online. Within just 10 minutes, it had accumulated 3.6 million followers. Later on Friday, the number had risen to more than 13.4 million. It's not clear if Trump, who is a prolific tweeter, whose social media posts have often proved controversial, will tweet directly from the new account. Shortly after the account was created, it emerged that the picture of flags being waved at the top of Trump's new profile was actually from Obama's inauguration in 2009. It was swiftly changed. The first post from the new account carried a link to the new president's inauguration speech. But Trump's personal account, @RealDonaldTrump, has been active since he took office. The new president still intends to carry on posting on his personal social media accounts after taking office, NBC News reports. A new account has also been created for Vice President Mike Pence with the handle @VP. An account also has been created for Trump's wife, Melania, with the handle at FLOTUS, F-L-O-T-U-S, First Lady of the United States, previously used by outgoing First Lady Michelle Obama. Trump has said he intends to keep running his personal account, telling the Times, "I'd rather just let that build up and just keep it up at Real Donald Trump." And he has vowed to carry on tweeting, claiming he has to do it because he does not trust the press.
He said, "The tweeting, I thought I'd do less of it, but I'm covered so dishonestly by the press," he said, "so dishonestly that I can put out Twitter, and it's not 140, it's now 280. I can go bing, 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 and they put it on, and as soon as I tweeted out." Earlier Friday, Obama posted a series of tweets reflecting on his 8 years in the White House. He tweeted, "It's been the honor of my life to serve you. You made me a better leader and a better man." And he continued, "I won't stop. I'll be right there with you as a citizen, inspired by your voices of truth and justice, good humor, and love." Throughout the presidential election campaign, Trump's postings on Twitter were heavily scrutinized and often controversial. Since becoming president-elect, Trump was no less confrontational, with CNN, actress Meryl Streep, and the security services among those he wrote negative tweets about. On his personal account Friday morning, Trump wrote, "It all begins today. I will see you at 11 a.m. for the swearing-in. The movement continues. The work begins."
Almost two-thirds of federal employees voted for Hillary Clinton during the presidential election, according to a new survey. The poll also found that 6 of 10 felt that the election itself gave Americans a negative impression of federal service. So it may come as no surprise that some federal employees are considering leaving their employment when President-elect Donald Trump assumes office.
More than 1 in 4 federal workers, or 28%, will definitely or possibly consider leaving their jobs now that Trump has been sworn into office and become leader of the executive branch, according to a survey conducted by the Government Business Council and Government Executive, which both track the trends of the field. Half said that Mr. Trump's business experience would hinder his management of the federal government, while almost two-thirds believe that his business relationships pose a conflict of interest. Both points are also popular narratives within the Democratic Party as well.
About half of those who will consider leaving are eligible for retirement and would do so earlier than they originally planned, while another 37% said they would seek another job outside of federal government, the analysis said. Just 1% said they would quit and figure out their next step at a later time, while an additional 12% said they were not sure what they would do.
Eating hot chili peppers may extend your life. According to a new study, researchers analyzed data from more than 16,000 Americans who were followed for an average of nearly 19 years and found that red hot chili pepper consumption was associated with a 13% lower risk of death, CBS News reported.
The study was published in the journal PLOS One or PLOS One. Since this was an observational study, it offers no proof of a cause and effect relationship, but does add to the growing body of evidence that spicy foods may have health benefits that can help people live longer, according to the University of Vermont researchers. Previous studies have suggested that a spice component called capsaicin may have anti-obesity, antioxidant, anti-inflammation, and anti-cancer benefits. The authors of this new study say capsaicin may also act as an antimicrobial, CBS News reports. The University of Vermont team called for further research to investigate the benefits of other spices and the effects of certain chili pepper subtypes. Such evidence may lead to new insights into the relationships between diet and health, updated dietary recommendations, and the development of new therapies, they wrote.
But spicy dishes aren't suitable for everyone, particularly those with gastrointestinal problems. For those who are affected by digestive disorders, such as stomach ulcers, I would be cautious about eating spicy foods. Lou Key, Harvard School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, told CBS News. Key was the lead author of a 2015 study that found regular consumption of spicy food is associated with a lower risk of death.
One of the Tesco supermarket branches in Scotland has just launched a relaxed lane for vulnerable customers who would prefer to take their time at the till. The store, located in Forres Moray, hopes that the lane will make grocery shopping easier for guests with dementia, autism, Alzheimer's, learning disabilities, or just a mother with several kids under her arm.
The project, developed with the assistance of Alzheimer's Scotland, will hopefully encourage shoppers to comfortably move at their own pace without feeling rushed. Though it is currently only a trial program, The Lane, open on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, has already received an outpouring of approval and support.
It was highlighted to me that people living with dementia can feel under pressure when they reach the checkout, and it struck me that this could be true for others as well, the store's Carrie Speed told BBC. Early feedback from customers has been very positive. Although it's a simple gesture, we hope this will make a difference.
It was none of his business, maybe, but Malik Bonnet didn't like the way the guy on the bus stop was treating the woman he was with, and she looked scared. He thought maybe he should intervene, but how? Bonnet decided to keep his eye on the couple and follow his instincts.
The 17-year-old cook had just completed a shift at work in Montreal, Canada, and saw his chance to help when the man asked him for money, saying he and the woman needed bus fare to get to the town of Laval, some 25 miles away. Thinking on his feet, Bonnet not only got the money for them, but also announced that he too was headed to Laval. He hopped on the same bus as the couple, and when they stood up to get off, Bonnet stood up too and offered to buy them dinner. Pretending to go to the restroom, Bonnet instead borrowed a stranger's cell phone to call police. So good was the teen's facade that when law enforcement arrived to arrest the man and escort the woman to safety, the kidnapper had no idea it was Bonnet who had tipped them off. The woman looked at me and she was almost crying, and I said to myself, I did good, Bonnet told CBC News. He did more than good, according to Laval Police Lieutenant Daniel Gurin, who told CBC that in 24 years of policing, he's never seen anything quite like what Bonnet did.
Bonnet didn't even know the police were already searching for the couple. The 29-year-old woman had reportedly been kidnapped a few hours earlier, and authorities were pretty sure they knew by whom, a dangerous ex-boyfriend who was under a court order to stay away from her. The Laval cops were so impressed with Bonnet's decision-making, which they said were probably saved the woman's life, that they took up a collection to reimburse him for the money he spent. They raised $255 for the quick-witted young hero. Bonnet was delighted to have his cash returned, and his proud mother bought up 8 newspapers as keepsakes.
A grocery store owner has been providing free education for slum children under a bridge in India for the past 7 years. 45-year-old Rajesh Sharma noticed the hardship faced by children living in the slum area of New Delhi and was driven to do something after he himself was forced to drop out of college for financial reasons. Sharma runs lessons from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. every day for nearly 200 underprivileged children. Subjects covered include English, Hindi, science, math, history, and geography.
There's no seats and no tables. There's only one wall, which is concrete and part of the bridge itself. I was strolling by and saw children of laborers playing in the dust and mud when this metro bridge was under construction, Sharma told BuzzFeed News. I spoke with the parents and asked, why don't you send them to school? They said, we want them to be educated, but we can't afford their education, and the school is too far. With no government funding, the school is reliant entirely on public support and donations. People donate books, uniforms, shoes, and food on a regular basis.
On Saturdays, the students play cricket, football, badminton, and other games with donated sports equipment. I love this school, says 15-year-old student Papu. I come here for studies and to draw. He walks 2 kilometers every day to reach his school. For Sharma, his day does not end after his lessons. The grocery store owner often goes straight to his shop, where he works until 10 p.m. That's your Breadbox Media News Out of the Box Weekend Edition. For Kelly Sergenis, I'm Joe Lerza, reminding you to always think out of the box.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.